Hello, welcome back to episode 24 of Prog Notes. My name is Destin.
And I'm Drew.
And today we are listening to Misplaced Childhood by Marillion. If you've never listened to our show, I'm gonna go ahead and redo that.
Oh, okay.
If you've never listened to our show, our goal, screw it. You guys know what we do here. Our goal is to educate and hopefully inspire you to uncover and learn about music from the progressive rock archives that you may have never heard of or want to learn more about. If you're coming back to the show, welcome back. And if you enjoy what you hear today, we'd be very grateful if you shared the episode to someone who needs to hear this awesome genre of music. And always be sure to subscribe so you will be notified when we launch a new episode. So, Misplaced Childhood is the third studio album by the British neo-prog rock band Marillion, released June 17, 1985, and recorded in Hansa Studios in West Berlin, Germany. Marillion was formed in Aylesbury, Buckinghamshire in 1979. Marillion has recorded 19 studio albums since 1982 and have two distinct eras, delineated by their lead singer. The first one being the first one being Derek Dick, otherwise known as Fish, who left the band. I can't. That guy's name, dude. If I had that guy's name, I'd have to have a stage name. It's bad. Anyway, who left the band in 1988 and the replacement Steve Hogarth in 1989. That being said, this album was during the Fish era. The other members of the band include Steve Rothery on guitar. I can't get through this, Drew.
Do you want to send me your notes and I'll just read them?
No, I got it. Steve Rothery on guitar, Mark Kelly on keyboards, Pete Trewavis, I think it's Trewavis, on bass, who is also a member of Transatlantic, actually, and Ian Mosley on drums, who played drums on Steve Hackett's two solo records, and the fifth drummer brought into the group. And so anyway, the writing sessions for Misplaced Childhood started in the late 1984, and the first side of the album slowly took shape after a disastrous recording sessions of their second album, Fugazi, which spanned across 10 studios and three different producers. EMI wanted a cheaper solution for the recording of the next album and sent the band to the utterly cheap and unknown Hansa Studios in West Berlin, Germany, which I believe was during the Cold War, if I'm right.
Yeah.
1985, Cold War, yeah.
Yeah.
So producer Chris Kimsey, who worked for the Rolling Stones previously, was brought in. And just a fun fact about Hansa, David Bowie had recorded his Heroes album years before at the studio. Anyway, the whole album was recorded and mixed within 2 months, which I find pretty impressive. Recorded a full record like this in 2 months. So, but what were the critics' thoughts on this whole record? I totally butchered that intro, but we're going to roll with it.
I'm sorry. Give me a moment. Okay. This was very well received. And I had heard of this record beforehand. Not only you, but a couple of our friends who also enjoyed prog rock had suggested this as a really solid prog rock record. And the critics thought so as well. I found very few reviews that were negative. There's obviously going to be a couple, especially when you look on places where it's user-generated content and stuff.
Right.
It, you know, where anyone can comment and all that stuff. You're obviously going to get some negative feedback. But for the most part, everyone loved it. It reached number one in the UK charts in 1985, number three in the German charts, number six in the Netherlands, number 47 in the US charts. So not as high as in Europe, but still pretty good. Cause that's on the Billboard 200. So you're in the top 50 there. Number six in, Switzerland, number 15 in Sweden, and number 10 in Norway. So it's pretty popular. This is a very popular. It's very popular for them, for the success of their band. That was their. This is the Marillion record. This is the record. It's like Dark Side of the Moon for Pink Floyd. Lots of other people like The Wall and some of their other stuff. But let's be honest, their best selling was Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
Or Moving Pictures 100%. For Rush. You know, they just have their landmark records, and this was the landmark record for this group. It stayed on the charts in the UK for 41 weeks, which is a considerable amount of time, especially with how much music is produced in and out and always has been over the last,
50, 40, 60 years.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, exactly. I mean, pop music's been going on for forever, and radio was even bigger back then than it is now.
Yep.
But it was the 20th best-selling album in 1985 in the UK. So very successful for them in both terms of numbers and as far as critical reception. I'll read you some of what I found on what people said about it. On Prague Archives, which I've mentioned several times, the user rating was 4.25 out of 5 stars. 55% of people gave it a perfect score, and 28% of them gave it a 4 out of 5, which is still really, really good.
Yeah.
I'll read an excerpt from some of these. You know what? Actually, I'm going to save that for after I've given you the numbers, and then we'll go into it, because these reviews kind of touch on a lot of topics that deserve further explanation.
Okay.
Analysis.
Okay. I'm down.
Sputnik Music, the featured review, gave it a 5 out of 5, and the average user rating on that site was 4.2 out of 5.
Wow.
Everywhere I found, people just genuinely really enjoyed this, and even on places that didn't really give an opinion one way or the other, the history of it was always mentioned in there as it being the band's most successful.
We've never done a record on the show, I think, as of now, where we've gotten like really awful across the board critic reviews.
No.
Am I right?
No, I don't think we've gotten one that has been like notoriously like
just
bad.
Notoriously just, yeah, crapped
that
on.
People absolutely hated. We've gotten mixed reviews on a couple of things, but I mean, it's like with any music, there's always going to be people who enjoy it and people who dislike it. So,
right. Oh, of course.
But yeah, for the most part, so the reviews, they were very frequently kind of referred to as a Genesis ripoff group.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of what I saw with these reviews, and just looking into the history of the group, is that lots of people thought they were very similar to Genesis, but they just came later. And you can hear it in his voice even.
It's just I think it's the voice. It's the voice. But then again, well, I mean, like
it's
Phil
the guitar
Collins
too.
And, yeah. Yeah. They have some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they are pretty similar. I see why they kind of got that rap in a way. And no one likes to be called a ripoff or anything, so I'm sure they resented that. But anyways, I preface that for this excerpt I'm going to read here from this review.
Yeah.
Marillion's excellent 1985 album. Oh, sorry. This is from the Prague Archives one.
Gotcha.
This is from Peter.
Prague. Okay. Why did you say his name like that? What is up with the name, dude?
No, I was expecting it to be like, oh, Peter Tilleman, or like have a last name, but I forget that this is like username stuff. So you'll have like...
It's just Peter.
Who wrote this? Who wrote this? It could be Mr. Prague Lover 22 or whatever.
Right, right, yeah.
But this is just Peter. nothing else. It's just one of the most common English names, male names there is. Okay.
It's Peter. All right.
Okay, what does Peter have to say? Okay. Marillion's excellent 1985 album, Misplaced Childhood, lends considerable weight to the argument that not all the best progressive rock was written in the 70s. Granted, this recording could never have happened if Genesis hadn't first blazed the trail that Marillion follow so well here, but that's just the way that art often develops. Marillion may be inspired by Genesis, but wasn't the music of Beethoven an edifice built upon the foundation that Haydn and others had laid? Regarding the often leveled charge of Fish's vocals being imitative of Gabriel's, I find it well within the realm of possibility that two people could have very similar singing voices and conclude, lucky me, having more musical choices is always good, and I simply like to hear Fish sing, passionately fronting this very polished and powerful band. And at the end, he said, in keeping with its theme, Misplaced Childhood shone out like a beacon of hope for the future of progressive rock in the 80s and still thrills today. It is recordings like this one, made some 10 years after the heydays of its progenitors? I don't know. Progenitors?
Maybe the people who followed?
I think so. Okay. That give me continued faith in the future of the genre, a latter-day progressive rock classic. Hmm. So he had great things to say about that, and I thought that was a good point to put in there. Is like, hey, this Genesis had to come first for this to happen, for sure.
True.
But, you know, everything is, in a way, influenced by other things, and you can draw parallels so many times on a bunch of different artists by stuff they did before, you know, by people who came before them.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. I'll also read a little bit from the Sputnik Music Review. Sputnik, you know, it's Russian, so it's obviously very credible.
Yeah, it's Russian, so it's credible.
Don't worry about it. This was written by Torontonian. Get it? Because he's from Toronto. Good for him. He's kind of embracing his heritage his username.
Kind of like Jonathan Marillion do, you know?
Sure.
White boys and, you know, the selling England by the pound, the whole Genesis.
Shoot. English we're just really thing. Reaching here. Okay.
Right, we're just really going for that one.
He gave it a 5 out of 5 on here, so he really enjoyed it. He said, the lyrics stay true to the spirit of childhood. Childhood is, of course, a phase of human life in which very few dams are given, a time where one can bask in the simplicity and carelessness sanctioned by lack of fiscal responsibility, a time where one can enjoy the simple pleasures in life to their fullest extent, a time in which every grown-up recalls in morose longing. For those reasons, Fish abandons any aim of lyrical complexity and directs his attention to creating the most wishful and visceral lyrics imaginable, purposefully trying to incarnate. Jeez, I'm sorry. My allergies are killing me. Give me just a second. Oh, that's good.
You're okay.
I'm great. I'm sorry. Let me start that over. For those reasons, Fish abandons any aim of lyrical complexity and directs his attention to creating the most wistful, not wishful. I couldn't see. My eyes were watering. Creating the most wistful and visceral lyrics imaginable, purposefully trying to incarnate the quintessence of childhood into lyrical form. Each and every song recalls youth into the listener's heart. And towards the end, he says, due to the heavy emphasis on vocals, the instrumentalists are somewhat felt to be pushed to the side, especially for the usual wank-filled norms of prog. Even the nearly 10-minute epic Blind Curve places true marvels such as Peter Trawava's secondary. Blind Curve places true marvels such as Peter Trawava's secondary to penmanship, something quite unheard of in prog rock epic, in a prog rock epic. But one must remember, this is an album made to commemorate a time where simplicity reigns. Getting caught up in the complexities and excesses of prog would be a fatal contradiction to what this album stands for. I thought that was interesting.
I like that.
I think that's kind of something that we'll definitely touch on later. But a big part of it is that this was part of the neo-prog movement. In fact, it had been called... let me see this. This album had been called the cornerstone of the entire neo-prog movement, quote unquote. And
oh man,
I think what I just read at the end of that is kind of a great way to describe it. It kind of neo-prog, I think, kind of stripped the excess of the pioneers in a way.
Yeah.
Not saying that it's actually my favorite, or that's necessarily a good thing. It can be. But that's something we'll get into later, I think, on the discussion of neo-prog and what it is and how I feel about it, how other people feel about it, what it is, et cetera, et cetera. I know you have a lot of thoughts just on the idea of, like, you're angry at internet.
The internet, it bothers me. It's bothering
me. The internet bothers you?
The internet, not the internet in general. The internet... on neo prog is, it just bothers me, like the way I went into some like really in-depth research for what is neo prog. I was like, okay, I really have never like coined, I've never said that term ever before this episode. Right. I've never been like, oh, what, you know, hey Destin, what's your favorite type of music? Oh, just, you know, prog rock and, you know, neo prog. I've never said that. Like, that's not like
neo-reactionary post-fusion dadcore.
Yeah, that's a genre. And
neon nightmare creature punk.
Yeah, creature pop. I don't know.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I don't understand. Yeah, but anyway, so like the neo-prog, I was looking this up, and honestly, when we were having conversations, you and I were having conversations, I thought the way that you described neo-prog was five times better than anything I found on the internet. I looked at several respected websites on neo-prog and how they're defining it. And what I found is that there's just so much inconsistency when trying to pin down what actually constitutes a neo-prog definition. Okay. Here, you know what? Screw this. I'm going to find it right now. Some statements I found online in attempting to label neo-prog. Hold on. I'm going to pull this up. I'm not even kidding. Dude, I'm not even kidding.
I think you're going to find that this is really only a huge issue for you. I'm just saying.
It really is. It probably is, but it's bothering me. All right. But this is going to set up success for you to be able to explain what neo-prog is. Okay. According to Prog Archives, it says this, quote, neo-prog is a subgenre of progressive rock that originally was used to describe artists strongly influenced by the classic symphonic prog bands that flourished during the 1970s. At the beginning of the neo-prog movement, the primary influence was early to mid-70s Genesis. Debate over when neo-prog actually came into being often takes place, some asserting it began with Marillion's script for Jester's Tear in 1983, while some even suggest Genesis gave rise to neo-prog with their 1976 album, A Trick of the Tail. The new form of prog rock originated in the UK and is most strongly associated with bands like Marillion, IQ, and Pendragon. Okay, first off, strongly influenced by the classic symphonic prog bands of the 70s. While searching the internet, looking for bands that were labeled as neo-prog, because I listened to a lot of them. I was trying to find out, like, what is this whole deal? It was amazing to see that in every single case of the bands that represented this subgenre were in fact in symphonic in nature. Like the lists would include, like I said before, I like IQ and also Marillion. I listened to some Jadis, Twelfth Night. I listened to some Pendragon, Arena, and in some cases I found people were mentioning like Spock's Beard and Glass Hammer, and I listened to a Flower Kings album and so on. And so like to my eyes with this whole thing, it was like, there's only symphonic bands. Like, I'm hard-pressed to name a single band that might be labeled as neo-prog and not be a symphonic prog band. If anybody can argue this, I mean, I'm sure somebody can, but there's a reason for this, and I really do think that the reason is that all these bands are, in fact, first and foremost symphonic prog bands, creating music that was in the same tradition as the original prog rock icons. If that makes sense. Like, each of the new bands incorporates new elements of the past, but then clearly have created their symphonic sound. Like, after 18 albums, to still describe Marillion as sounding like Genesis, like, kind of seems crazy to me. If we're to be fair and honest, I think Marillion sounds like Marillion in their own respect. Like, I could see some of the similarities and stuff, but I think they've separated themselves enough from Genesis to be Marillion. But bands like these are clearly second, third, or maybe even fourth generation symphonic prog bands. Like, if you were to compare, no one labels the Rolling Stones neo-rock, even though the blues and rock music of the late 50s and early 60s influenced them. Like, sorry for the rant. But anyway, my contention is that the neo-prog is not distinct from symphonic, but it's in fact every bit symphonic in nature. I just don't think, like, it's not a subgenre of symphonic because the bands identified are clearly holding true the symphonic trademarks. I don't know. After listening to, like, all kinds of different kinds of it, it just doesn't, I don't know. I can't separate those two.
So you think that, like, neo-prog and symphonic prog are, like, kind of synonymous?
Basically, yeah. But then I'm like, okay, what are they describing both of these to be? What does it sound like? The musical components, right? So I went online and looked that up. And, like, the stuff that I found, if I can remember, like, according to Prog Archives, like, I was looking at Prog Archives, Wikipedia, like, allmusic.com. It's typed by the use of, this is what it said. Here's what it said right here. I found it. It's typed by the use of atmospheric guitar and synth soloing with symphonic leanings, with a tendency towards floating synth layers and dreamy soloing. Another trait is the use of modern synths rather than vintage analog synths and keyboards. Which I find that to be misconstrued from the very beginnings of rock and roll. Technology has played a part in the forming of the sound of each era. That was true with the guitar technology in the 60s, the keyboard technology of the 70s. The sounds musicians make are the reflection of the day. Every era had its distinct signature sounds in some respect. Fact was, in the mid-80s, everyone in every musical genre was using the mother of all digital synthesizers, the DX7, the Yamaha DX7. So to single out a few prog bands that were also using those new digital sounds seems worthless. Like, are we? It's like putting some arbitrary higher standard on prog artists and their choice of instruments. Like, who's imposing that? Like I was telling you beforehand on the before we got on the show, Rick Wakeman, he was using new technology side by side with old, like the Moog and the Hammond organ. Like, he would have those on stage, but like those bands were used old with the new. But like, regardless of the sounds that they use or were created or whatever, the use of new technology, which was around in the 80s here, you know, was like very much an integral part of prog rock, and certainly no reason to marginalize those who do so. It's just strange to me. Like, you can't identify neo prog just by simply digital keyboard sounds, because that's just what everybody did at the time. And coming from like a symphonic, coming from symphonic in nature, but then they would go on, oh my God, dude. Then they would go on and they would say that neo prog is less complex than other symphonic prog. And I'm like, how subjective can we get? Like, Moody Blues, for their first 7 recordings, created music that was a form of what today might consider complex, yet few can deny that it's symphonic prog roots. Like, there was still that symphonic element to it. The music's simplicity is hardly a case for calling it neo-prog. Complexity is hardly an appropriate form of measurement for this kind of music. Like, there are so many other contemporary bands like Glass Hammer, or, you know, that I mentioned before, like Spock's Beard or the Flower Kings, and many others, whose music is not only far more complex in terms of composition, but also just like arrangement and musicianship. Like, complexity alone cannot be used to single out certain bands to call them neoprog. Was 80s Pink Floyd neoprog? Shoot, I don't even think it started in the 80s. Like, if the bands of the 80s make the neo-prog group, then maybe those of the 90s should really be called really neo-prog. And then the nose of the new millennium, we could call them, Drew, we could call them retro really neo-prog. Like,
retro neo-prog.
Yeah, retro really neo-prog. I don't know. Where does it end if we go down that road? Like, what?
I thought it was an 80s thing. I thought neo-prog was kind of an 80s... And that's where the term started, and that's when it got pinned on a lot of things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, later in the 90s, other terms started to be thrown around, like alt-rock and indie rock and stuff like that. And,
right.
You know, you get bands, and the grunge movement started in the 90s and everything,
right,
too. And so I thought, and maybe it's just because Marillion is the quote-unquote, this record particularly was the cornerstone of the neo-prog movement, I look to that and I see it as a very 80s sounding record.
Yeah, 100%.
In a lot of respects. And so I was like, I feel like if you're going to attach this as the quintessence of neo-prog, then a lot of other 80s sounds are going to be, you know, neo-prog is going to sound like the 80s because this record sounds a lot like the 80s.
Because it sounds like the 80s. Yeah.
That may be a logical fallacy. I don't know.
Yeah. I just, like, the neo-prog as a term, like, as a term, to me, just has no justifiable support. Like, neo-prog as a subgenre of symphonic prog, I just don't think can be logically supported by argument. I just think the term really has... Well, and to what they're saying online has no value at all. Like, it didn't make any sense. I mean, I got so, like, caught up in what they were trying to tell me, because I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Because, like, if you listen to a band like Greenslade, who I found when doing research online, they're really cool, actually. I would highly recommend checking out Greenslade. They showed up around, like, 1973, 3 or 4 years after King Crimson. Yes, Genesis, you know... They came into existence after the genre's leaders. Like, it's, they had, if you go and listen to them, to check out their sound, it's almost quite like this, you know? And so, I mean, yeah, you got the people who are the genre's leaders who are taking the whole neo-prog, or taking the genre in its particular area. But there's just, I can't find a way to be like, where did this really start? I mean, I know that's always going to be argued. You know what I mean? Like, it could be argued when Prague started. It could be argued when Prague started. Like, did it start with? Exactly. Yeah. Like, that'll always be argued. That doesn't really get me caught up on it. But, like, just, yeah, I can't see any justifiable support online. But what you were telling me, and that I really, really like, though, is that, okay, like, let's say, for instance, we're just taking this album, right? We're listening to Misplaced Childhood Marillion, and they're saying that this is like a cornerstone neo-prog record, okay? So the elements of this, are they different from prog rock in the 70s? Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're absolutely. But because it's different, does that make it a totally separate subgenre? That's where I'm getting like, okay. Because the things that they're using to describe what neo-prog is, it just doesn't make any sense. Like I mentioned before, it doesn't make any sense. The musical components, all of that stuff, it's just because time happened. Like, we moved into the 80s. Music is changing now because of new stuff, new technology, and all of that jazz. So anyway, I'm sorry. I totally ranted right there, but I kind of warned you beforehand.
You're good, but because it changed, then you do kind of need a new term for it. You do need a new label to slap on it. Okay, maybe needs strong of a word. But that just happens when something sounds different and there are common elements that are missing and or added.
Yes.
People like to put a different term for it to attach. Yes. Oh, it sounds like this or that or that or that.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
And it's hard
to
put labels on it at all. We've actually talked with a couple of our fans about like the importance of labels or questioning the importance of labels just in general on, you know, or terminology per se on different genres of music and all that stuff. And it's sexy and interesting conversation. But do you want me to go into what I...
Yes, because I agree with everything you're saying, like with the separation of like, okay, we have something new, how do we describe it, and yada yada yada. The way that the internet did it, I think just sucks. Like, they did not describe this well. There's so many logical fallacies that just can't be supported. But what you were telling me was actually more outside of the way that it sounded and more compositionally. And I really like that.
And I don't know if this is right. This is just what I have observed from a lot of the prog bands that lasted into
the 80s. Yeah.
The pioneers like Genesis and Rush, and even Pink Floyd to an extent. And Marillion, and just kind of looking at all of them and thinking what you could put a new term on. So you've done much more research, and you have music historians on your side to argue with. Not on your side, but to argue with in that whole conversation. Mine was kind of a self-invented definition, so that's kind of fun. I don't know where to start. It's hard to define, just like any other musical category, like classic prog in general. Like,
right,
just,
yeah.
That's hard to define anyways. But a couple of elements that were different. The lyrics were more personal, and or relatable rather than ambiguous and metaphorical. The concepts weren't set in fantasy times or with bizarre creatures. I mean, look at the Colony of Slipper Men from The Land Lies Down on Broadway.
Right.
Or like Hemispheres from Rush. Like, you know, these like Greek mythology incorporated and these weird worlds that you visit while you're listening to this music. It wasn't so much that. The lyrics seemed to be from a modern point of view and contained struggles or situations that most people could relate to. Note how Neil Peart's lyrics became more digestible during Rush's 80s sound and were more emotional or expressive rather than being shrouded with esoteric vocabulary or bizarre worlds.
Which you talked about on our Tribute to Neil Peart episode.
I did.
Like, you talked about how everything in the 80s, or I think he more so specifically said the 90s, but like it started in the 80s where like stuff started getting a little bit more personal to Neil. And
we started talking
about more things that were universal, like emotions and stuff like that people go through.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that kind of happened with Genesis, too. Now, granted, you can attribute some of that to the fact that Peter Gabriel
changed
left the band.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, in 1975, after the Lamb Lies Down tour. And Phil Collins took over. And whatever the reason, Genesis did start to write shorter, more radio-friendly tracks. They still had some prog elements in those in their albums, though. Every now and then, they would have longer songs like "Tonight, Tonight, Tonight," where they have kind of an instrumental breakdown that's, you know, and the whole song lasts 8 minutes, or like Duke's Travels, which is, you know, yeah, 7 or 8 minutes
oh,
long.
Oh, Lord.
And they, both of those songs have kind of these experimental musical breakdowns. So, I mean, and, you know, Rush did it too. Rush actually was a bit shorter, I feel like, than even Genesis in the 80s. In fact, there are very few 80s Rush tracks that I can name that, if any, that go over like 5 or 6 minutes.
Well, the last one to go over 10,
I mean,
was The Camera Eye in 81.
I mean, yeah.
I think. Gosh, I think that's right, because I think we discussed
right.
that on the Moving Pictures episode. That was the last song that they did that was over 10 minutes. And so
right.
all throughout, yeah, 82, 84, 85, 87, 89, and then
yeah.
up to 91, 93, all of those yeah. records were under, all the songs were under 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, on top of that, because it kind of, you know, kind of goes hand in hand, most concept albums have longer tracks on them.
Oh, 100%.
And I mentioned that to say that because the songs started to be shorter and more radio friendly and more direct lyrics and everything, concept albums were not as common with neo-prog. And again, this is my self-invented definition.
Right.
But I say that, and it's ironic because this album is neo-prog, the staple of neo-prog, and it is a concept album. Granted.
Yes. Yeah.
It is. It's kind of vague. We'll go into that later.
It's got a theme, yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't seem as like conceptual or as story based as something like 2112 or Hemispheres, again, both Rush records, or even Lamb Lies Down on Broadway
yeah.
or The Wall. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's musically conceptual. There's a lot of musical motifs that return, like the stuff from Lavender.
Some of the songs flow. You have like this thin thread of like, okay, maybe it's this one character that all these things are happening to. But it seems more autobiographical than it does a different weird world. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yo, yeah. 100%.
And again, I think it's kind of cool, though, that they kind of combine, I mean, concept album, the idea of this happening to a certain character they've created, with more relatable topics and themes
yes.
and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I think
Dark Side did that to the best extent possible, because I think
right.
Dark Side is a very relatable album, and it's a concept album.
Right, you know? Right. No, totally. I absolutely agree. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Another thing that I found in neo-prog is that the keyboards really took over everything. And that keyboard was a big instrument for the beginning and of prog rock, to be, you know, at the start of it, right? I mean,
yeah.
think about Tony Banks.
Yep.
And think about even with early, or when Rush kind of became prog and less just rock and roll, which is what they were doing at the very beginning, they incorporated more synthesizers, and Getty
yeah.
would play the keys and synth pads with his feet.
Yep.
And he would take a break from playing bass and start playing keyboard solos. So, and crud, as we talked about with the Beatles, they started to incorporate more
right.
mellotrons
yeah. Mellotron
and
stuff.
Electronic
same with King Crimson
keyboards. Exactly. So that's always been a thing, but in the 80s, it kind of overshadowed the guitar. And you can see that effect in, again, I know we're such Rush nerds, but that was a big problem for them, because it was like, okay, where's the guitar now? And Alex, their guitarist, had a big problem. And think about it. With Genesis, they became a trio.
Yeah.
And they lost Steve Hackett. Now, Mike Rutherford picked up the guitar. He's a multi-instrumentalist. But the iconic sound of Hackett's voice was gone from the group. There are some cool guitar parts in their 80s stuff and stuff without Hackett. But there was a signature sound to the guitar, and the guitar was a key component of early Genesis records. And
oh,
it was
yeah.
absent.
That's undeniable.
It was not
yeah.
nearly as important or... yeah, I guess I'll say that. As prominent.
Yeah.
In their music afterwards.
Well, I think what happened with the keyboards and everything, they started becoming more... I mean, if you think about it, like if you think about the Hammond organ and you think about some of these older instruments, the Mellotron, like a lot of it was sitting in that sort of low mid-range in terms of like a frequency scale. Like it was sitting underneath all of the high guitar parts and stuff. With the newer technology coming into play, now you have much more complex sounds, stuff that's clearer to hear, and things that have a lot more higher frequencies involved with them. So they could start doing, and I'm not saying that they couldn't do this beforehand, but they started doing that more. They started taking over more soundscapes and started using leads in higher areas. So it was competing with the guitar rather than being like a sound bed, like in the Court of the Crimson King, you know, where it just has that massive mellotron in it. It was more of like a lead instrument. And that's, I think that's what attested to, which is because of the technology, attested to the stuff that was happening during this time with the guitar and the keyboards and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that was just a sound of the 80s that every, like you mentioned earlier, every band from almost every genre was using this. And that's just, yeah, like you say, that's just technology. That's how it changes. And you know, that's progressive in a way. That's how music changes. That's how music evolves, right? Technology is a huge part of that. And why wouldn't you, right? I mean, you can't do the same stuff over and over. Part of what made prog rock to begin, what it was to begin with, was the fact that they did utilize and take advantage of new sounds. And guess what? That's you know, the 80s was a time where a lot of bands did that. Granted, a lot of them did kind of sound similar because they kind of used them in the same way.
Yeah. But it was new at the time. People maybe didn't know how to use them at that point.
I think most people would agree that the 80s were not a great time for progressive rock, per se.
Yeah.
It was not
as inventive, or I mean, that's all arguable. I mean, but we're listening to an 80s. I mean, we're listening to a song or an album right in the middle of all that stuff. I mean, we're in 1985 with this record, and we're reviewing it on the show. So there's a reason why it was so big,
right?
And how it impacted maybe future prog rock and maybe into the 90s or so. But
I'd be interested to do another neo prog record.
Oh, same here.
Look more. I'm sure we'll do that down the road. But just looking kind of more into neo prog and what it is, and like, okay, what are the parallels we see between, you know, whatever record we do and Misplaced Childhood, and what are the differences? What are the, you know, so it would be interesting.
100%. Yeah, there. I mean, we've had a couple of people ask us if we were going to do stuff in that area, like IQ. We've gotten some recommendations for IQ and some Pendragon. We'll definitely do it because I'm so curious about it because of all of the stuff that I've been looking at with the neo prog thing. I'm so curious to hear what other stuff sounded like, because really, like, when it comes to anything outside of like 80s Rush and a little bit of 80s Genesis, I don't really listen to a whole lot of prog rock coming from the 80s.
Same.
Except for and this record too, because I've listened to this record for a long time. This was probably this was newer to you, right?
Yeah, I had heard this a long time ago, and it wasn't my cup of tea, and I didn't really dig into it, so I had forgotten a lot about it, and then I heard it again. So that opens it up into my impressions of it, if you want to go down that route.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I was going to ask you what was your first thoughts on it, and listening to it now, like, you listened to it then, wasn't a big fan of it. I knew that going into, or when we were starting this, but did you have anything change after listening to it maybe a few years later?
Yeah, no, I liked it more. And this show has definitely helped me kind of expand my musical palette and be more, I guess, considerate. Just really being more objective when you're looking at a piece of music, even if you don't like it.
Except for Pawn Hearts.
Oh, shoot. That's going to be just a common trope on this show.
I'm sorry.
That is. And we've gotten so many people being flack. Like... Yeah, so many people being like, you know, and they've honestly been respectful about it. They've been like, I get it. I didn't like it at first, but like the seventh listen around, I loved it. I'm like, it took you seven? Like, it takes me a couple. No, it takes me like a couple listens. I get it. I totally get it. Needing multiple listens to kind of let it sink in and 100%. Enjoy something. But I'm sorry, if you're going past the number five, I think at that point, you're just under hypnosis. I think that you just like, in a way, you're so like chained to this piece of music.
Oh, you
want to
like it so bad.
It's like Stockholm syndrome. It's like you've just started to relate to your the people who have captured you, and just oh my gosh. Your captors are now your friends. It's Stockholm Syndrome. Oh. That's what Pawn Hearts is. That's what it is. If you like Pawn Hearts, it's because it has, like, stolen your soul away.
Oh, my gosh.
And you just now have, like, okay, this is now I am signing my life away to Supreme Leader Man Erg. God, I don't know. Sorry, we're ripping on it too much. We're going to get torn apart for this.
It's not that bad.
And that's the thing. I hope people realize is that we joke about hating it, and we do. But it's one of those things that we don't... No, not that bad. And obviously, if you like it, then that's cool. That's totally awesome.
Oh, man.
Shoot.
All right, I'm playing your favorite song on the record. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you like some of the elements on this album particularly, like more personal opinion about it.
Sure. I'm gonna go into my whole thing here. All right.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm gonna start from the very beginning. It's a very good place to start.
Just kind of right? Your overview of the whole thing.
See like what I did there? The Sound of Music. Did you get the reference?
I
just forget it. Just forget Muzak? It.
Muzak? Is that what you're going for there?
Yes. Going for music. Anyways, I remember hearing this and not liking it, and I listened to it this time, and I listened to it a couple times. I did enjoy it. It is one of those things where the majority of the songs on here have a pleasant melody in almost all phases of the song.
Yeah.
Album. Of the entire album, most pieces on here are just really well composed.
Yeah.
They're pleasant melodies. They're good, strong rock songs.
Yeah.
Here's the thing though.
Holy crap.
First thing I noticed way back when I heard this several years ago, and then again listening to it now, it reminds me a lot of corporate rock or arena rock.
Arena rock kind of stuff.
Like Journey or Boston or Def Leppard or Scorpion and Poison. Not hating on these bands at all, but they all kind of have their formula. You know what I mean? They all kind of have their formula, and they all kind of have a similar sound, and it kind of... You know, kind of that music that blurs the line between, you know, kind of that rock / hair metal type of music, you know, Bon Jovi and all that kind of stuff where it's very formulaic music, right? I mean, Kaylee sounds like that to me, that track.
Sure.
It's very produced and very simple. Not bad. Again, enjoyable melody.
Yeah.
Well written. Very good guitar tones. I say good. That's a very vague term.
But what you're hinting at is like we're loosely labeling this as being prog rock. Is that what you're getting at?
I'm going to keep going because there are some definite identifiable prog pieces in here that you don't find in Guns N' Roses or Scorpion or,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the American rock.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Americanized version. Yeah. But in this album, there's basic guitar solos or droning ambient guitars over broad keyboard chords, simple chord progressions, predictable, albeit pleasant melodies, building arpeggios, high male vocals that remind me of Steve Perry from Journey. I think that's why I wasn't a huge fan of it at first. I'm just going through my notes here.
Sure.
It does deviate from the norm and shows its progressive colors with spoken word portions like in Bittersweet. The fact that they speak in it, I think that that's not something that instantaneously makes you a prog, you know.
No, yeah, yeah.
Classifies you, but it is common in a lot of them because it's kind of conceptual and it's a bit theatrical and perform, you know, kind of in a performance in a way. And that kind of makes me think of art rock, which again is kind of on the cusp of prog rock and very similar to it.
Yeah.
And songs like Waterhole have that unorthodox vocal melody. Right. But still really fun and very groovy. And, you know, it does have longer songs. Right. It has these pieces like, you know,
Blind Curve and
Bittersweet and all that stuff. So it's very theatrical with the vocals, like I said.
He's got that kind of Gabriel kind of feel.
And it sounds like a musical in a way, like it's sung by a character in a show.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Does remind me of Peter Gabriel, like you said.
Yeah.
So, yeah. they do blend together as well, which kind of makes it a concept album. I think that helps lend to the idea that it is a concept record.
That's what I was mentioning before. It's like musically, the musically, the way the album is composed, it makes it sort of conceptual. There are definitely that sort of conceptual hints to it with the flowing of the song. Like, you know, you have a 2-minute song flowing straight into a 9-minute song and stuff like that, as well as the musical motifs like that, the thing from Lavender comes back in several different areas of the record, and that to me sounds very, is a very kind of like, I guess, concept album trope, or if that makes sense, or even a musical trope, to return to stuff like that. But yeah, from the lyrical content side, you were like, yeah, it's kind of, kind of. But
there are some that's really good. Like, there are parts in there that are really good, and I don't think it has to be super esoteric or anything. Like I said earlier, but that was a key element of the early prog rock pioneers, and I don't know. I know I hold him up on a pedestal, but Neil Peart just had a way of creating both intellectually satisfying and yet relatable lyrics in the 80s.
Yes.
He just had a talent for that. And I think that in and of itself was kind of prog rockish, where it was like, the topics are simple. There's things that a lot of people can relate to, but the way you word it is a bit, it makes you think a bit more than it would be than just saying, you know, I miss this girl. Also, that's the other thing. It wasn't just love or, you know, rockin', or, you know what I mean? Like the rock and roll lifestyle that a lot of, you know, bands like AC/DC, again, these kind of American bands seem to really
there's the American
focus on.
Yeah.
But, anyways, it this album also doesn't like showcase very much virtuosity either, as much as the early prog rockers. There are some sections that are cool and that are complex with some on time signatures and really interesting coordinated riffs and rhythms, like the Lords of Backstage.
Yes.
That's my favorite one.
Oh, it's great.
But
yeah, Waterhole.
And Waterhole too.
Yeah.
Both of those are terrific.
Because it just has like, there's a lot more movement in those tracks. Some of the other ones are, it's a very slow album. Like, if you notice, like, the tempos that most of these songs are at are really slow.
Yeah, it's pretty slow.
It's a slow, not like, not metaphorically slow, but literally just a slow tempo album for most, for a lot of it. Then, you know,
right.
I mean, White Feather, Lords of the Backstage, Waterhole, it's got a mix, but
I think the thing that really got me about this record, in a bad sense, the reason I didn't really care for it back then, and the reason that now it's still just not really a top one for me.
Sure.
Is that a lot of the songs sound very similar. And it's not just because they incorporate the motifs again over and over, but like, just what we're listening to right now. Like, the drums are just very basic.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on in the background? Very long.
Yeah, diamonds. Just
diamonds being played.
Diamonds with a solo.
So there's broad guitar in a lot of these songs. A lot of them. Not all. A lot. Broad guitar and keyboard chords behind an ambient lead guitar riff or solo. Sometimes they add a reverby guitar arpeggio on top of this while the lead singer takes over.
Yep.
But
this is the best part of the entire thing right here.
The sounds are very well designed. Very well designed. I'll give it that.
It's a great sounding record.
It is a great sounding record.
Yeah.
It's produced very well.
Yeah.
But they just, a lot of the tracks sound super, super similar to me.
I get that.
It just seems very basic. I think one thing that
We're on the argument here of it being like prog rock. Not the fact that you didn't like it or like it because it was not complex enough or yada yada yada, right? That's the conversation that we're having right now. This is really just more about like your personal taste with it, not personal taste with it, but like we're more so talking about like the reasons why this is like prog rock kind of.
I was drifting in between the two topics.
Okay. I was giving, are we talking about like you didn't like it because it was this, or you did like it?
No. Okay. This was just my personal taste.
Gotcha.
But earlier I was talking about what does make it different from
other
pieces and why it would be considered prog.
Okay. All right.
Because it, you know, it is. It is. It absolutely is prog rock, but it's interesting. It's an interesting mixed bag. I did enjoy it. That's the one thing that I want to be clear. They're pleasant sounding songs. They sound good and they're fun to sing along with. And you know, again, it sounds really good. The sound even of just the drums too, and everything.
Oh, it's got that 80s. It's the 80s sound.
It's a very 80s sound, but it works very well combined with the guitar tones that you've got in there. So,
yeah. I have a theory when it comes to the way that the album was composed, and I may be totally off here, but it's something to think about. There's a quote that I found online of Mark Kelly talking about this record, and he says, quote, "It was the album that saved us." And what did they needed to be saved from? Well, you know, in 1984, I mean, they were looking pretty good from the outside. Like, they had 5 top 40 singles, 2 top 20 albums with Script of Jester's Tear in 1983 and 1984's Fugazi. But in fact, they were actually in danger of being dropped by the record company EMI.
Yeah, so, I saw that too.
Yep, for their last single, I think it's Assassing. I don't know if that's pronounced correctly. As they done with the whole of Fugazi, there were quotes, we were liable for 50% of the costs. So, looking back, we were on a bit of a knife edge. Kelly says. So, Script of Jester's Tear had sold about 120,000. Fugazi cost twice as much, but sold less. So if we carried on the way we were going, we weren't going to be financially viable. So, you know, if they're starting with the whole, you know, prog, which they had that sort of neo-prog fan base coming from the prog rock stuff, the Genesis whole thing, that was kind of their fan base going on in that area. It could be argued that they did this out of fear, wanting to simplify some things, possibly. Now, to the other two albums that beforehand, I have not listened to them, so I don't know the differences between maybe how out there or how risky their previous two albums were. But some could possibly argue that this album was safe and it was easy to try and get a radio hit. And Kaylee was supposed to be formulaic because they needed money. They needed some cash because this band was not going to be going on if this record didn't do well. So I have no evidence of that online whatsoever. That was just something I deduced from the information that I found online about the record and where they were going into this. As we know with 2112 by Rush, they said, screw you guys. And we're going to continue doing our own thing.
I think that, you know, that was kind of Marillion in a sense too. They were kind of similar to that because I don't think it was
same
meant
situation
to just kind of argue a little bit with that. I don't think it was meant to be safe per se.
Yeah,
because the fact that it's a concept record in general.
Yeah.
Maybe they struck the balance. Maybe like this is a concept record, but there are some very commercial tracks on here that we can put singles that we, you know, can make singles.
Yeah. I mean, Kaylee's Marillion's most successful song.
Right. And Laughter was really big too.
Yeah.
So maybe they kind of struck a balance between the two, but I don't think they went into it saying that this needs to be safe because the whole origin of the idea of this came from an acid trip, and you can't really be very safe with that. So
yeah, exactly. yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
I saw a couple reviewers say that that this exercises restraint in a good way.
You were telling me about that.
Yeah, it's perfectly concise. Sometimes prog does wander too far off. It just does, and it lacks restraint. This is not overly grandiose with song length. It lasts as long as it should on each track. That's the best
way
to say it.
Last it long as it should.
Yeah, and each track has value and a pleasant melody. Like, there's a reason for each one of the tracks on here. And even if you don't like one as much as you do the other, it doesn't seem to go on too long, let's put it that way. And I know a lot of people can complain about Prague and say that it does sometimes just wander a bit too far.
Yeah.
But this is perfectly concise for a Prague record, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, like we mentioned before, the compositions are just, like, they're good. They just are. I mean, the way that the album is constructed, it's concise and it doesn't wander. And what you said before is that they held restraint,
right,
which is like they had possibly more to give, but chose to keep it. Maybe they chose to keep it simple or chose to serve the music in the way that it needed to be served. I don't know. I mean, whatever that mindset was, I don't know that. I wasn't in the band, so.
Right.
But yeah, I like it. That's a good way of describing it.
Right. I think we could talk about the concept if you want. It's a concept record, supposedly.
Yeah. Yeah, we should talk a little bit about it. I'll just say this. I think ultimately the theme running through the album is inspired by his life so far.
Yeah, I think so too. It kind of like I'm like, all right, this is kind of like a autobiographical, but like, I don't know, it reminds me of Forrest Gump. It's not really much of a plot in Forrest Gump. It's just you're going through this dude's life events, and it's very captivating.
Dude, that is
all the
good
cool adventures that he's had.
That is good.
It's not
a book per se,
mentally challenged or anything, but it's right. Just kind of it's like a series of different things. This is what I said. I also said it was very melodramatic, which is something that I always have a problem with.
We need to get you a shirt that says
I do. I do. I have one already.
You do?
One of my friends from college. Yeah.
Oh, you mentioned that.
Yeah,
that's
we made
right.
each other shirts because she loved noir films. And like a lot of times when she would see a film and it reminded her of like a noir trope, she'd be like, oh, that's so noir. And whenever we watched something with me and I really disliked it, a part of it was because the performance was melodramatic. And I was like, that's a little melodramatic. Like, okay, tone it down. And she got me a shirt that said, that's a little melodramatic. And so I got her a shirt that said, that's so noir.
That's hilarious.
So anyways, but this does seem very melodramatic in some senses. But as far as the actual content of the concept, I say the songs focus on a man who is coming to grips with the world after a series of depressive episodes, heartbreak, like with Kaylee and Lavender, drunken states, like in Waterhole, and, you know, engaging in, you know, prostitution, and all of that with Blue Angel section of Bittersweet.
Yeah.
And he's doing these things to numb the pain, and he's realizing the injustice of the world. Like you see that on Blind Curve with Threshold, that whole section, all of those lyrics deal with like, hey, how can you, you know, he describes a series of really horrible things happening in the world. And then, so it's just kind of a bunch of really sad/crazy things going on through his life because he doesn't like the way the world is. He doesn't like the way he is. He doesn't like the way his relationship ended.
This guy needs some therapy. Hopefully with the money that they got from this album, he went and gotten some therapy. You know what I mean?
I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope so. But then it takes a hopeful turn at the end because he sees a reflection of himself as a child. And it like, that's the whole theme of it is a child, you know, misplaced childhood. And he's focusing on the innocence and beauty of the, kind of that childhood mentality of dreaming and seeking of a better world, a world where it's not as complicated, blah, 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 a world where you're not having to give in to the man or the powers that be, in a political sense or even in a corporate sense or whatever, right? So that's kind of the end, is like in the childhood's end, that song, he's just reflecting on himself and he sees the child within himself and he realizes the dream, the childhood dream, and the youthful spirit doesn't have to die. And you know,
which,
and you know, the whole
personally, sorry, go ahead. Continue.
No, you go ahead.
What I was going to say is I wanted to add a note for that song. We're going to listen to Childhood's End at the end of the episode, but I love the musical depictions of the lyrics in that song. Like, it's very light and uplifting. Those guitar chords they fit very well. I like the way that all of that sits, and it's I really like that song.
Right. But, and then, you know, at the end with White Feather, it's kind of this, we're all joining in together, this whole, like, almost like we are the world in a way, you know, because they're singing all the, what does he say? The,
I don't know, let's find out.
Shoot.
Yeah, just play it.
Let's find out real quick. Hold on, hold on. It's something, is he saying children? I'm trying to remember the lyrics now. Sorry. I don't know them as well. Yeah, no, it's children. I was right. All okay. The Chicago children, you know, children. People are singing that in the background while he's still singing. We will carry your white flag. We will swear we have no nation. Blah, blah.
Yeah. That's a cool song, too. I really like
it's
this
song. It's a good
song.
It's a good song. But, like, it's this, that's the end of it, is where, you know, kind of has this idealistic ending of, like, uniting to make the world a better place and defying the injustice of political powers. You know, he has all the world's children, quote unquote. And I think what children is supposed to be there is children, meaning the childlike spirit in everyone.
Yes. Yeah, I would
uniting
agree.
Uniting to make the world of, a better place and defying the injustice of political powers and corporate powers, everyone above.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And coming out of this as well, I mean, Fish at the time when he was writing this was 27 years old. So he's in that area of starting to feel the loss.
He's kind of on that verge of entering into the whole adulthood.
Yep, exactly.
Which is not all it's cracked up to be, kids.
Shoot.
Yeah. But it's, again, it's an interesting, oh, and you know, he had this whole concept while he was on an acid trip. And yep. I love the way he, like, the story. I don't know if you read this, Dustin, but the story. Sorry. But the story was he hadn't taken acid in a while. And then he takes it. He takes half of it, right? Because one little bit of it will do a lot. Yep. And
I mean, I wouldn't know.
He takes half of it and it didn't kick in yet. And he was like, I guess I've built up some kind of tolerance. Or he just didn't think it worked or something. He was like, I'll take the second half, too.
Yeah, on his way to Steve Rothery's.
Yeah.
On his way
and
to his
he
house.
Was like, it turned into a bad trip. And out of that, he kind of wrote this whole thing. But he wrote, I think, the whole concept in a fair portion, if not all of the lyrics, in like that trip in like 10 hours. It's kind of 8-hour stint of him being kind of stoned. And then he wrote it in that time. It's an okay concept. Again, I think
it's not groundbreaking, but it is grounded in reality. You know,
but it's, I again, yeah, like you said, I kind of like that it is more grounded in reality, but I don't know. There's something to me about the fantastical elements of kind of the early prog where you can, I think, unfortunately, a lot of prog pioneers didn't really articulate what they were trying to say very well. It seemed like they were creating worlds without actually having a message to what that should be.
Sure.
Or if they did, it was just super obscure. It was hard to tell. You like, no one can understand what you're saying. I mean, look at John Anderson's lyrics.
Yeah.
Like, what is it? What?
What are you doing, dude?
Close to the Edge makes no sense. It's one of my favorite records, but it's not something you can easily identify what the hell he's trying to say. I will say, and again, always put them up on a pedestal, and I always will, but Neil Peart was one of the few exceptions where I was like, I know what he's saying. The whole hemispheres thing is dividing between, you know, the kind of duality of man. Are you someone who's very logical and reasonable, or are you someone who enjoys feeling emotion? And obviously you can be both, right? And that's a universal concept.
And everybody is,
a lot
yeah.
of people can relate to. And it was set in a Greek mythological universe.
Yeah.
And you know, Cygnus was a character he created to be the balance between the two. Like, that's a really cool idea. And it's yet the topic is something people can relate to. So
right.
He didn't always succeed. I mean, Cygnus X1, the first one, is like, what? It's just a cool jam. But who is this guy? Why
right.
is he going
yeah.
here?
Yep.
But on the whole, he did a great job compared to a lot of early prog rock. Again, these bands that I love, but their lyrics, let's be honest, are kind of like, what?
Kind of nutty.
What? They're kind of shoot. You got some nutty stuff.
Some nutty stuff.
Anyways,
I have a fun
that's the end of our show. Bye.
Holy crap!
We're gonna
Drew's gone.
Bye.
I wanted to say this because I find this to be slightly ironic and kind of funny to me, but Kaylee, like I said before, it was Marillion's most successful song, but the success led to turmoil for Fish. I mean, he ended up leaving the band a few years later, and I find this kind of sad in a way, because when I looked up, like, trying to find out the reasons why he left the band, he said a few years later he blamed it as being, quote, self-inflicted paranoias and negligent management.
Is he saying management from, like, the music company or self-management?
I guess, probably. I don't know. Right. Probably music. He's probably blaming. I doubt that he's taking the blame on that one himself. But, and then they obviously regrouped with the new lead singer being Steve Hogarth, who first appeared on their 1989 album, Season's End. Another fun fact I wanted to tell you about is, I told you about this, that Marillion opened for Rush.
Yeah, they did. Yep. Yeah, I read that too.
On two different tours. Once on the pre-Grace Under Pressure tour for a five-night stand at Radio City Music Hall in New York City in support of the Fugazi album. And then again on the Power Windows tour in support of Misplaced Childhood. And I found this in a book called Marillion Separated Out, The Complete History, which can be found on Amazon. There are a few excerpts of the tour with Rush performing Misplaced Childhood that I find kind of hilarious. Quote, this is an excerpt from the book. Then it was time for a second bash at those West Atlantic shores, playing five nights at New York's illustrious Radio City Hall in support of Rush. It all sounded wonderful. The stage was enormous. We had to take a lift to get to it. That's elevator for those not versed in Brit. However, if the last tour attempt had been a crisis, this was an abject disaster. The band were restricted to 10-minute sound checks and limitless rules and regulations about what Whoa. They could and could not do. But before the gig, there were invariably be a Peter Gabriel or Genesis track playing. At the time, Marillion was trying its hardest to remove any perceived association of the music to Genesis. And when we actually walked out on stage, the fans treated us like unwashed peasants. It was awful, terrible, and humbling. The audience hated us. I remember one guy standing on a seat in the front row with his trousers down. It was a nightmare.
Wow.
Said, quote, end quote, Mark Kelly, the keyboardist of Marillion. Later wow. in the book, which I find hilarious because I just don't see Rush fans doing stuff like that. Maybe in the 80s, obviously in the 80s they did. But that sucks, dude.
Wow.
But later in the book, in March of the following year, 1986, the band finally reached the west coast of the USA. It had taken Misplaced Childhood, along with its 25,000 US album sales, to convince Capitol Records that a full US tour would be viable. Even then, 12 of the 23 dates were supporting Rush's stadium crowds on its Power Windows tour. This was a brave move considering the band's last attempts to support Rush. However, this time the band had achieved success in their own right and were no strangers to 20,000 member audiences, and had received Rush's assurances that there would be no repeat. This time, quote, this time they asked us back, recalls Mark. Quote, when we arrived, they left a bottle of champagne in the dressing room. Indeed, the time the crowds were more receptive. Rush's legacy proved strong. Our audiences have always been the strongest places when we toured with Rush, comments Mark.
Wow.
Thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So they had, but that sucks. Dude. This album, they toured this album with Power Windows and Rush, and they hated it in the US. They hated it. And following year, it took them a hot minute. They had finally 25,000 album sales, convinced Capitol Records to do the tour, went on tour with them, and their audience proved strong. And Rush's audience liked the record and liked how it was when they performed with Rush. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So, and that was from, like I said, if anybody's interested, it's a book called Marillion Separated Out, The Complete History. And you can find it on Amazon if you just type it in. So.
Oh, also just one more fun fact. It's not a surprise. In 2017, who else but Steven Wilson, obviously, did a high-resolution stereo and 5.1 surround mix of the record.
Yep.
So What a shock, right?
What a shock.
He's
there.
Remixed every prog thing.
Oh, it's crazy.
He's got his name on everything.
He's done everything from Tangerine Dream to freaking XTC to like,
right.
I mean, it's everything. He's done all kinds of different remixes and stuff like that. So,
yeah.
But anyway, wow. We actually talked a lot about Neo Prague, I think, and just the whole idea of this entire era more than the actual music itself. But hopefully we pleased some people with our thoughts on it. We do have some really, really good news for everybody. And we'll kind of shift gears for a little bit. Unless you have anything to say that you would like to...
No, I'm okay. Good. That's,
yeah. Great. We have some really, really awesome news. The reason why Drew and I started the show was to connect more people to progressive rock music. And the feedback on that has been absolutely incredible. I mean, the show has introduced... We've talked to people who never heard of prog rock, who listened to our show and now found an album that they really enjoyed. We've also attracted some avid prog fanatics, you know who you are, to the show. Something that comes up frequently in our conversations with you all via email and on Instagram is that we all don't have many friends or family to share our music taste with. So what we're going to do is try and help and change that.
Yeah, so we've started production on a Prog Notes newsletter. It's called Show Don't Tell, which it just includes a bunch of bonus content from our episodes, prog playlists that Dustin and I have created, news from the prog world, different reviews that we have found that we have referenced on here or may have excluded on here, materials we mentioned on the show, like back with
the book,
you know, the book in Deloused in the Comatorium.
Yeah.
And all that for that episode.
Yep.
The big thing, I think the biggest thing is there's going to be on this newsletter, you can click and join once you've gotten the newsletter for the Prog Notes community Discord channel. So we love connecting with you guys through social media. That's like, it's really awesome. And through email, it's excellent.
Great.
But now we'd love for you guys to talk with each other about this and see what different listeners have to say. About what we've talked about on the show, what they think some of their favorite prog music is, and just a big community for people to kind of share and listen, their thoughts and opinions about this genre.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So we're going to roll this out extremely soon for everybody. So if you'd like to join, you can check out literally any episode's podcast description, including this one, for www.prognotespodcast.com/community-signup. It's 100% free. We'll post the link all over social media and our email to make sure you have access to it.
Yeah, we're super excited to share more prog rock material just with all of you.
Oh, yeah.
And connect with all of you guys on a regular basis. It'll be fun.
Yeah, so hopefully we can... Now, we've connected with you all, but we'd like to connect you with each other and maybe create a little bit more of a community for all of us. And first on the agenda for this community channel is a game. And I've told Drew about this game, but he has no idea what this is.
No, you've just said, I've got a game.
I've got a game that is going to be kind of cool. So what I've done is I have packed together 22 snippets of songs from the show that we've covered in 56 seconds. And if you can guess all 22 songs in order, you can post the answers in our Discord channel. Okay, so you're probably gonna have to get ready to pause and rewind this because you'll probably need to hear it twice. Okay, you ready for this?
Oh shoot! Hold on.
All right, you want me?
I need a pen and paper?
You probably need a pen and paper. You're not gonna be able to write all these down that fast.
You didn't tell me I'd need paper.
I didn't tell you that. I mean, we are in the digital age.
Hold on. Right? Give me
22 songs in 56 seconds. So yeah, I mean, type it out if you want to. All right.
Hold on. I don't know if I type or write faster. No one knows. Hold on. Let's create a new little fresh document here.
Yep.
Hold on.
All right, here we go. Are you ready for this?
Oh, hold on. Okay. Hold on. There's 22 of them. Okay.
It's 22.
There's 22 of them. It's number 22. One. Let's go.
Here we go. All right. 22 songs, 56 seconds. Here they are.
Whoa. giving up.
What do you think? Did you get all 22?
Not at all. I didn't have time.
Okay, yeah. So everybody can head over to prognotespodcast.com/community signup. Join and post your answers. You can connect with other prog fanatics, maybe find some more prog outside of the one album a month that we do. And make sure you guys sign up before May 31st of 2020, because that will be the day the first newsletter launches. And that is... that is it. So
wow. I've got to take it piece by piece. Jeez.
It's a lot.
That's so fast.
I know. It was a lot. So.
Oh, man. Well, we'd like to thank you all very much for listening to our podcast.
Whoa.
These are our prog notes. If you enjoyed the episode, learned something new from the episode, please subscribe to our brand new newsletter and share. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at prog_notes. These links are in the show's description. Destin, what is the next episode that we're doing? What's the album that we're going to cover?
Yeah. So next episode, we're going to be discussing Grow by the American prog and math rock band Chon. So we're going to dive into, we've done some neo-prog here. We're going to dive into some of the math rock side of modern prog rock. And since most of the album is instrumental, joining us on the show will be a man by the name of Pusher. He is a musician and producer from Toronto, Canada. He's toured internationally as a DJ, supporting artists like the Chainsmokers, Diplo, Phantoms, and Knower. I personally discovered him online on YouTube doing an analysis of a Bill Wirtz track. And I was extremely impressed with how he analyzed the music and explained it. And so I'm super excited for him to join us and talk about this band. You guys don't want to miss this. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's it for us, guys. Join us next time as we discover the past, present, and future of prog rock. We will end this episode with Childhood's End.
Not to confuse with Childhood's End off of Obscured by Clouds, because it does not have the question mark. That's how you delineate between the two songs, at least in my iTunes library.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Oh, my. All right, guys. We kind of derailed that ending there. But we will see you soon on our community channel.
See you guys soon. Thanks.